Welcome, friends. This is Economic Update, a program that we bring to you every week. It's an analysis of major economic events and trends, the forces, both national and global, that shape our jobs, our incomes, our taxes, our debts, pretty much everything about the economic dimension of our lives. I'm your host, Richard Wolff. I've been a professor of economics all my adult life at several universities. Currently, I teach in the graduate program for international affairs of the New School University in New York City. I also write columns of economic analysis for the website truthout.org, a courageous, independent source of news and analysis that I urge you to take a look at. For those of you that keep sending us information, suggestions, links, questions, please continue to do so. Send them to either of our two websites, rdwolf.com or democracyatwork.info. These are the websites we maintain to give you more analysis, more of what you hear and see on this program, more of what we refer to in these programs. It's a way for you to find out more, to pursue your interests in this whole area of the economy that touches all our lives. And it's also a way for you to send us your questions, which we answer or try to on this program, either by specifically responding to your questions or weaving your topics that interest you into the programs that we create. So again, if you want to send us your questions, your comments, positive or negative, use our two websites, rdwolf.com with two Fs or democracyatwork.info. Finally, please remember to follow me, Richard Wolff, on Facebook, Twitter, and Pinterest. Let me turn then to our economic updates for today. I want to first talk about something that became public this last week that may have escaped your notice. It has to do with a report in a journal you may not look at on a regular basis called the Chronicle of Philanthropy. It keeps track, you might say, of charitable donations by some of the largest donors in the country. And what caught my eye recently, and that of a few other people, was the listing for the banking firm Goldman Sachs. And therein lies a lesson. And so I would like to present that to you briefly. The way we measure, or the way you could measure donations, charitable donations, is by asking what percent of the profits the company gets does it use to contribute to charity. I say this because sometimes folks want to argue that corporations should be given a pass or a pat on the back because, quote unquote, they give something back. So I thought you might be interested in what they give back to charity, particularly in recent years. So let's begin, and I think you'll see there's actually more than one lesson here. Between 2002 and 2008, a nice spread of years before this crisis hit, Goldman Sachs each year gave an average of less than one-half of 1% of its previous year earnings to charity. Let me do that again. Out of its previous year's earnings, in any given year, out of the previous year's earnings that they had left over at the end of that previous year, they took less than one-half of 1% to contribute to charity. Yes, you're giving something back, but what you're giving back is very, very small. Then, of course, the crisis hit, 2008 and 2009. You might have thought the banks would cut back even the little bit they give, or at least Goldman Sachs would, because their profits too were hurt. But if you thought that, you'd be wrong. Because Goldman Sachs knew right from the beginning that they were going to be getting a lot of attention because they were right up to their bankers' eyeballs in all of the mistakes, the legal and illegal moves involved in complex markets that helped bring this crash. They knew they would have to spend more to kind of counteract the bad publicity they were getting. And true enough, in 2008 and 2009, the contributions to philanthropy at Goldman Sachs shot up from less than half of 1% of the previous year's earnings to 6% of the previous year's earnings. True, the previous year's earnings had gone down, and that alone would account for some of it, but my guess is they were putting money in there because it was a kind of advertising to offset the bad press their behavior had won them. In 2010, it dropped again to under 2%, but I guess the last couple of years have been rough on banks, so it went up to 4% again in 2012. Not a lot of give back, to say the least. But you can look at the ups and downs of their give back as an effort to try to polish their image, to use charity as a PR maneuver. And here's another PR maneuver of the big banks. Last week, a lot of attention was devoted to a deal being worked out between the government and J.P. Morgan Chase, one of the nation's largest banks centered in New York. And according to the press reports, it's not yet a done deal. The amount of money that the J.P. Morgan Chase is going to have to be shelling out in this settlement with the government is in the neighborhood of $13 billion, making it one of the largest settlements ever. And we were all supposed to focus on, whoa, look at the size of that. Isn't it enormous? Isn't therefore, in a sense, punishment fitting the crime? They have to come up with serious money. Well, I would again submit to you, this is PR. This is an attempt to suggest to the world that they are making amends for what they did. Let's put it in context. $13 billion is one half of last year's profit. And this is for behavior mostly having to do with the mortgage mess that J.P. Morgan Chase had been involved in for at least 10 years, if not longer, before this time. So that we're talking about a fine that was one half of the profits of 1 year for something done over many, many years. This is a way to suggest we're putting all that behind us now. We've paid our debt and we're moving forward. A stunning attempt to use either charitable donations or settlements with the government as public relations to cover over what the banks did and what, from all signs I can see, they largely continue to do. Second update, still with the banks. These days, they push themselves onto our attention at every turn. This story has to do with what you might think is an obscure initial fact, but you'll see where we can take it. The Dutch bank, Rabobank by name, settled with the government over its role in manipulating international interest rates, known as the LIBOR scandal, L-I-B-O-R, London Interbank Offer Rate. And this bank is going to pay, as other banks have already paid, millions and millions of dollars to settle the manipulation of interest rates that, of course, affected many billions and billions of dollars. Still awaiting settlements are huge other banks that have not yet been caught up in this. Barclays has already paid a huge fine. Swiss banks have paid huge fines. Deutsche Bank and Citigroup and others are still awaiting what kind of settlements they will have. To put this in perspective, remember what banks have admitted to and paid fines on already besides the LIBOR manipulation. I'll just make a partial list. Money laundering, taking illegal money knowingly and cleaning it up by moving it around the bank system. Charging excess fees of all kinds. Manipulating the mortgage markets in all kinds of ways. And finally, the whole pattern of speculation, securitization, manipulation of derivatives that helped bring the crisis upon us in the first place. Banks really have been doing it. You might think that would affect the attitude of people towards the banks. You're right. Bank popularity, confidence in the banks is at historic lows. But not when we get to the United States Congress. This last week, the House of Representatives voted to repeal yet another component of the Dodd-Frank supposed regulation of the banking industry. What was repealed was a provision which basically said that banks could do trading in derivatives, but they could not do it with money that was insured by the federal government, because then the taxpayer, in the end, would be on the hook if the trading in derivatives in the future had the same kind of disastrous results it just had in the recent past. Well, our elected representatives in Congress, in the House of Representatives, wanted no part of that. Overwhelmingly, not just Republicans, but lots and lots of Democrats, voted to repeal that provision so that we, the people of the United States, remain the final backstop for whatever failed risks, for whatever mistakes private banks make in the derivative markets. As that issue got hot, of course, the predictable happened, namely that a debate. Those who wanted against it trotted out the tired old story. The government shouldn't intervene in the economy. The government, when it intervenes, only makes matters worse. The government is the problem. Turning everything over to the private and getting the government out of the business of intervening or regulating is the way to go. That was the argument that won the day. Nicely forgotten is who it was that saved these banks in 2008 and 9 when they all went bankrupt. The government. And who was leading the charge to Washington to get the government to come in there and give them trillions in guarantees, trillions in subsidies, trillions in investments? Why, the same bankers who now, having gotten all that money from all the taxpayers, now want the government to butt out so they can resume doing what they were doing before. You know, you have to take your hat off to these folks. There's a level of courage in the face of overwhelming evidence that you have to admire when you're not crying in your beer at the mere effrontery of it. And let me make a final comment about leaving things to the private sector. As I hope you know if you listen to this program, I don't find the whole argument between public and private terribly exciting. It is what passes for economic debate in this country, but mostly I think it obscures what the real issues are, which are not about whether a government official is running the enterprise we work with and in, or whether a private elected board of directors by shareholders is doing it. But the best example of what we get if we leave an industry to the private sector without government regulation is our health industry. We have four private industries involved: doctors, hospitals, the producers of drugs and medical devices, and finally, the medical insurers. They've got a sweet deal going. They work together. They sometimes have struggles amongst themselves, but they work together, getting the following result. Here in the United States, we spend 17 or 18% of our total income on health. No other advanced industrial country does anything like it. Number two spends roughly half of that. And yet the United States medical outcomes, no matter how you measure them, are mediocre at best. We're not better than many other countries. So we spend twice as much as everybody else, and we get mediocre results. We don't have the government step in, which is what every other country does. And every other country, therefore, spends half or less than we do and gets as good or better medical care. We don't do that because private and government are better. We do that because these private industries want to make money, and they do it by having a government they either control or they keep out of their business. For the rest of us, not so good. Let me turn in my next update to the housing industry in the United States. And I wanted to talk a little bit about it because it has been one of the few quote-unquote bright spots, so-called, in the quote-unquote recovery we're supposed to imagine is happening all around us. So I was struck by a report in Bloomberg Financial Service, also carried in the Wall Street Journal recently, about what part of the housing economy is recovering. Turns out houses are being built. And that's true. Some houses are being built. We're still at a rate of house building way below what we were before this crisis hit. So the notion that we have recovered is absurd. But more interestingly was what houses were recovered. And here the story from the Wall Street Journal and Bloomberg is indicative. Over the last several years of this so-called housing recovery, 2 or 3 years, there's actually not been any recovery at all in houses costing $250,000 or less. Building of those houses has continued to decline. Not only is there no recovery, there is continued decline. Houses between $250,000 and $300,000 to build are flat. They haven't gone up at all, no recovery. So what housing has recovered? Houses worth over $300,000 in cost to build. So what we see here again is a society splitting more and more into two camps. Those whose housing is not being rebuilt, not at all. That's the majority, the middle and lower income. The houses that are recovering, like the stock market and corporate profits, is those who have big bucks to spend. Last thing that I thought also was very interesting in this housing situation was the report of a number of huge investors, Blackstone Group being the leading one, who have been going to the cities where housing prices dropped the most, Las Vegas, San Diego, a whole bunch of places like that, and going in when they calculated that the prices had dropped dramatically. And by the way, why did the prices drop dramatically there? Because people were losing their jobs, because people's jobs were paying them less, because they had to take whatever money they had and help their children pay for school. And so they lost out on their mortgages, and they had to leave their homes after almost pouring half or more of the value of that house into the house. They couldn't keep up their payments. The houses were abandoned. They became unsellable. The price collapsed. Wasn't unusual in these areas for a $300,000 house to be selling for $40,000, for a $500,000 house to be selling for $80,000, and so on. In came these investors and bought the houses at the bottom, paying next to nothing for foreclosed houses, auctioned houses. And they're converting them into a new industry. They're very proud. The one-family rental industry. What that means is you take a house built for a family, in which a family lived, into which a family poured its savings for 2 or 3 years. You create an economic crisis. The family can't make the mortgage payments. They leave. The house is next to many others like it. The price of the house collapses. In come the investors, taking rich people's money, buying up. Blackstone boasts it has done this with 40,000 houses across the United States. It's getting investors' money to go in and buy the houses cheap and turn them into rental properties, converting millions of lower-income Americans who had their first chance at owning their own home, having been told that was now possible, teaching them the bitter lesson, we had you in there, we soaked up whatever money you had, you're now gone, and we're turning it over to a new group of people who are going to be renters because that's all their income will allow, and we're going to make a bundle off of the process. If I had time, I'd stop and play the national anthem. Next, I want to tell you a different kind of story, one that I found remarkable and touching and moving in a way, so I want to spend a moment on it, even if it eats a little bit into our time for the longer discussions. I want to introduce you to a Benedictine nun. She comes from Spain. Her name is Sister Teresa Fercades. I hope I'm pronouncing it correctly. She comes from Catalonia, a very important and historically rich part of northeastern Spain. And she is leading a movement. And it's a movement that is part of a larger movement. As Spain descended into one of the worst cases of the victimization this crisis has caused, you know, Greece is the one that's in the press a lot, but Spain is suffering the same 25-27% unemployment rate, an unemployment rate for young people in their 20s and 30s that is over 50%, a catastrophe economic decline leading huge numbers of Spanish young people to leave their country as Greeks are doing. So there is a crisis in that society which impacts Catalonia, whose capital is Barcelona, as well. But here's a movement that says, we're not going to take it anymore. We are going to change all of this. We're here in a movement in Catalonia, in this province, called Procés Constituent. I'm not going to try to pronounce that properly. It is led by Sister Teresa Fercades, a Benedictine nun, and by a professor at the University Autónoma de Barcelona by the name of Arcadi Oliveres. And here's what they're planning to do. We are going to create an end to all evictions, replace people in their homes, end the extortion from the banks. The list goes on. It's what you would imagine a reasonable response of people to this kind of situation is. No more spending cuts, no more austerity. If there has to be payment made for a decent way of living, it comes from those most able to pay, those who have become the richest over the last 30 years, and those whose behavior had a lot to do with bringing the crisis. We're going to change everything. Here's a statement from the professor. Quote, the absurdity is based on the sacrosanct idea of private property. All the property the banks have acquired should be made available as social housing. Well, there's a response to the housing and banking crises that is refreshing and different. Sister Forcades, for her part, says interesting things. We have democracy in name, but not in reality, because the broad current of opinion, which is that the system must change, is not represented. Corruption and the sense of entitlement on the part of the main parties is the same in Catalonia as in the rest of Spain. Wow. And let me tell you a little bit about Sister Forcades. She's a medical doctor as well as a Benedictine nun. Not only did she study in her native Barcelona, but she also studied at Harvard, Massachusetts in the United States and Cambridge University in England. She says her political epiphany, her word, came when she discovered the excessive influence of pharmaceutical companies on public policy. Wow. She teaches theology in Berlin. Take our hat off to Sister Teresa Fercades, who brings another concept of morality to what it is she is doing. Last thing, tiny thing, but one of those tiny things you can't not comment on. Here it goes. The medical department of the state of Kansas in the middle of the United States issued its report for 2012, wherein it was stated that the suicide rate in Kansas jumped 31% from the previous year to 2012. That is a stunning change. What in the world is going on? And I want to thank one of my perennial listeners, Ron. I don't offer the last name without permission, and I haven't gotten Ron's permission, at least not yet. And that's my fault, not his. What's going on? And the little bit of effort that has been made by journalists to begin to get an answer to this question has led, for example, in the Wichita, Kansas Eagle, a major newspaper in that state, to a comment from the director of mental health in that state to say that their funds have been cut from the state by over 50%. And that has led to having to take all kinds of shortcuts in the mental health system. And so she suspects that that may have meant that people who were getting mental health care or help lost it or lost part of it, and that may have contributed something. They have a very high portion of people in poverty that has gotten worse in Kansas, as in many other states. So you begin to look at the larger social changes. What it costs to a society to have unemployment, rising poverty, cutbacks in state and local assistance for health and other purposes, and you can begin to see why so many people understand these to be issues of life and death. In Kansas, they certainly were. Let me turn now to the question of major discussions. And I want here to deal with some topics that have crowded in on more and more people. I want to begin with a short one before we take our mid-program break that deals with banks, because obviously today banking is much on the mind as banking has been much in the news. And I want to go back and explain something I have referred to in earlier broadcasts, but that has led to many of you asking me questions. The questions have to do with public banking, that is, with the idea that a banking system need not be completely privatized the way we do in the United States, with the one exception I'm about to tell you about. Most other countries have a mix of public and private banks, and it is not at all unusual, and it is something re-endorsed over and over again in the many countries that have this. So just like most countries, advanced countries, have a nationalized health insurance, we don't. Most countries have plenty of public banks, we don't. But it is peculiar about the United States, and something a self-critical society would have wanted to talk about long ago. But I told you there was one exception, and I want to talk to you about that exception. It is in the state of North Dakota, not otherwise known for radical difference. But for almost 100 years, almost 100 years, they have had a public bank. Indeed, it's the largest bank in North Dakota. It's called the Bank of North Dakota, and it is a state bank. It is not private. It is owned by the people of North Dakota and administered by the state. And it works on a very simple idea, which I want to get across because it's an example of public banking. Not the only example. Public banks can do many other things beyond what the Bank of North Dakota does. But it shows you, A, that it's possible, B, that it's here in the United States, and C, that it's the beginning of what could be a proper national discussion about what the social role of public banking ought to be. A discussion long overdue and especially appropriate now that we're living with the consequences, the awful consequences of a system of banking that is resolutely, defiantly, purely private profit-oriented. So what does the Bank of North Dakota do? Basically, it takes deposits from only one depositor. The state of North Dakota, if I understand this correctly, deposits all the money paid into the state. You know, the taxes people pay to the state, as they do in every state. The fees paid to the state for, I don't know, hunting licenses, driving licenses, dog licenses, all the money that comes into the state to pay for all the things the state does for the people. That money is taken by the government of the state of North Dakota and is not put into a deposit in a private bank. That's what the other 49 states do. In North Dakota, they put their deposit, all that money, huge amount of money, the old state, into the deposits at the Bank of North Dakota. And what does the Bank of North Dakota do with those deposits? Exactly what private banks do with the deposits they get. The difference is the Bank of North Dakota is required by its charter to serve the people of North Dakota. So here are the loans it makes to students of North Dakota, to homeowners for mortgages in North Dakota, for farmers in North Dakota. Get the picture? And here's the really interesting part. They typically offer significantly lower interest rates than do the commercial private banks in the first place. Oh, and they're much more careful, and they don't engage in speculations in derivatives or anything else. But here comes the part you might find most interesting. Despite being careful, despite offering better terms to their own people, the bank turns a profit. And because it's a state bank, here it comes now, folks, they take the profits and return them to the state. Money flows into the state from the bank, which allows the state to lower the taxes it might otherwise have to charge the people of North Dakota. In other words, the state uses the money paid in by the people of North Dakota to help the people of North Dakota, and then turns over the profit from helping the people of North Dakota to lower the taxes the state has to levy on the people of North Dakota. You know what you call that? A win-win-win situation. And how did you get it? by shifting from private banking, which is what the other 49 states have, to public banking in North Dakota. You know, when this started almost 100 years ago, it was often referred to as a socialist banking system. But what you need to remember is in those days, the word socialist was a good word. It got you elected to office all over the United States. Many state legislatures had loads of people elected on the Socialist Party ticket. In later years, private bankers, threatened by this idea of a public bank, tried to have the Bank of North Dakota shut down, canceled, voided. They failed. They used the charge, "You're socialist, you're so," still didn't work. The farmers and the others in North Dakota understood, and they didn't care what you called it. They knew how well it benefited them. And here we are again, once again, the taboo against socialism beginning to fade, the obvious failures and shortcomings of capitalism everywhere on view, and interest is turning again to the Bank of North Dakota. Please stay with me. This is Richard Wolff, Economic Update. We will be back after a very short intermission. Welcome back. This is the second half of Economic Update. I'm your host, Richard Wolff. I want to remind you briefly that you can pursue all of the topics we discuss here and view the kind of analysis that is represented here by going to either of our websites, rdwolff.com or democracyatwork.info. They are all available 24/7 at no charge whatsoever. Please make use of all the materials that we put there. And also, once again, please follow us, me personally particularly, on Facebook, Twitter, and Pinterest. One of the topics that I have wanted to talk to you about for quite a while has to do with this set of policies called austerity. It gets an incredible amount of play. It's going to get more in the weeks and months ahead. I know we have dealt with it and we've talked about it, and I know you've sent me many questions, but it is elusive. And so I have tried for today to condense it down to a presentable set of ideas that'll help you, I hope, understand what this is all about. The word austerity applies to the second step of a two-step policy to deal with this crisis. These two steps have been the same, whether the country is Britain or France or Germany or Spain or Italy or the United States or Canada or Greece and so on and so on. So what we're talking about is the basic two-step policy that all major governments living in a capitalist world system, that's what they have done to try to cope with this crisis, global crisis of the capitalist system. So let's go through it sharply and clearly as I can. Okay. The crisis begins second half of 2007 and deepens across 2008. Banks are becoming bankrupt, businesses collapsing, unemployment is soaring, housing is being abandoned. You know what happened. most of you paid attention at the time, or had it impact you personally. What was to be done was the immediate question. Something had to happen. And everybody, let me underscore that, everybody, right-wingers and left-wingers, Republicans and Democrats, liberals and conservatives, all in a rush, where there are a few exceptions, there always are. But the overwhelming majority of people saw no problem whatsoever in figuring out where to rush to get help in this disaster, as it was termed, the government. The very institution endlessly criticized for being ineffective, inefficient, unneeded, and all the rest, was the place everybody went. Help was all that was said. And mostly it was, help us with money. We're banks who dare not lend it to anybody, but we can't make any living if we don't. We're banks who have to borrow to keep our businesses going, but no one will lend to us. Please help us. We're homeowners. Help us from losing our home. We're corporations. Help us from having to lay everybody off, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. The government responded to this overwhelming consensus and poured trillions, with a T, into the economy. It rescued the banks. It rescued the insurance companies. It rescued General Motors. It guaranteed the loans of banks. It did extraordinary things with extraordinary amounts of money. So the first question was, how would this be paid for? This enormous largesse of the government, designed and focused to save capitalism from its own implosion. The first answer of corporations and the rich in America, as in most countries, was the government should do it right away, be generous, but don't you dare tax us to pay for it. Let me say that again. Bail us out, rescue us, do it right away, be generous, don't you dare tax us for a nickel of what it's going to cost. Well, the government said, as any rational institution would, well, then how am I going to get the money? Answer of the corporations and the rich, borrow it. The government said, well, we already have a fairly high national debt. We've been borrowing for years, for wars, for other things. Who cares, said the corporations and the rich. We have a crash here that can kill the entire economy. You have no choice. Borrow it. So the government did. So step one of dealing with the crisis was for the government to rescue the banks and other large corporations with huge amounts of money, plus a little thrown in for the average person. These are called stimulus programs, bailout programs, to massively stimulate and bail out and to borrow the money to do it. Now, that borrowing had two important things for you to keep in mind. First, it raises the national debt. Obviously, if the government is borrowing huge amounts of money, and in those years, for example, the United States alone borrowed more than $1 trillion a year, a trillion, it's going to raise the total indebtedness of the country, which happened in all countries because they all did it, some more, some less. Okay, the second thing to keep in mind is to have this question. From whom did the government borrow? Answer, it didn't borrow from middle and low income people because they don't have anything to lend to the government. They borrowed from, you guessed it, corporations and the rich, and indeed from one another, governments from one another. So let's recoup, though, with that focus on corporations and the rich. They didn't pay taxes for the government to be able to bail them out. Instead, they got the government to borrow the money. What money? The money the corporations and the rich didn't have to pay in taxes. The money they saved from taxes, they turned around and made available to the same government as a loan, requiring that government to pay them interest and to pay them back. From the point of view of the corporations and the rich, this was a win-win situation. We avoided the taxes, and we got government loans paying us interest, and we get all the money back. No wonder the corporations and the rich had that as their plan. If you understand the sweet deal that this represents to the corporations, you're halfway there. Now let's look at the second step of this two-step program. Suddenly, the government is, of course, saddled with enormous, huge new debts. That makes corporations and the rich have a problem, a fear, a worry. First, worry, maybe the government won't pay us interest and debt because they can't. There'll be kind of a revolt in the society, and we will not get paid back. That was not part of our plan. So they want everyone suddenly to be focused not on the unemployment and the home foreclosures, focus on the debt. The debt is, we've got to get the debt under control. We have been inundated in the last 2 years with endless publicity that our problem in America isn't unemployment, isn't the suicides of people in Kansas, isn't cutbacks in social programs, it's the debt. You know why we all discuss it? Because corporations and the rich are worried about it. Second worry they had was, whoa, maybe the idea will catch hold in the population that the way the government can raise the money to pay interest and repay the debt to the corporations and the rich they borrowed from is to tax the corporations and the rich to raise the money to pay the interest. The corporations and the rich don't want that, just like they didn't want to be taxed for the bailouts and the stimulus in step one. They don't want to be taxed to raise the money for the interest payments in step two. So here they come with the solution. Ready? Austerity. The way that the debt has to be handled is by cutting government expenditures, not by raising taxes on anybody, but above all, not on the rich and the corporations. The answer is austerity. Why? Because if you cut government programs, you free up the money that can be used instead to pay off the interest and the debt, to make sure that the government deficit doesn't add to the debt. So austerity is preferred, and austerity is what Republicans and Democrats are doing. Republicans want more, the Democrats want less, but they both support the idea. No tax on the rich is being proposed. No tax increase on corporations is being proposed. The only tax increase so far in 2013 was the payroll tax as of January 1, which fell most heavily on middle and low income people. The big cuts are in expenditure. Austerity is a way to make sure that not only were the corporations and the rich not taxed for the stimulus and bailout of step one, but they're not taxed to cover the interest costs of borrowing in step one, now that we are in step two, having to pay for this. The one consistent part of all of this, don't tax the rich and don't tax the corporations. The power of corporations and the rich in this country to shape the conversation and the debate in this way, that we're only fighting over how big the expenditure cuts is a testimony to how a tiny percentage of our population can control the whole structure of a debate to make sure that the number one priority is absolutely certain. No tax on corporations, no tax increase on the rich. Cut everything before we do that. That's not just what Ryan says, that's just not just what Eric Cantor says, but that's also what the folks around Obama say. They only differ on which cuts, in what order, and how bad they'll be. But there's no need for any of it. An alternative would have been, and is now, tax corporations and the rich. Why? Simple. They're the ones who bear most of the responsibility for the crisis in the first place. That's why they're paying huge fees to burnish their image by charitable giving, by making a big to-do over a settlement with the government. They know who they are and what they did. They made a fortune in the last 25, 30 years. The gap between rich and poor has become very wide in the last 30 or 40 years. The rich and the corporations are in a better place to pay for the coping with the crisis they caused than anybody else, and than they have been in half a century. That's the first reason. The second reason is they have gotten away with economic scandalous privilege. That's long overdue to fix that. Number three, the rates of taxation on corporations and the rich have fallen over the last 40 and 50 years dramatically. So we're just talking about bringing them back, let alone doing what would be just. Now, some people, when I explain all this, say, wow, if you tax the rich and the corporations, that would have consequences. They might invest less. They might be. Absolutely. But it's not as though what we're doing now doesn't have consequences. We are cutting funding for health, for education, for our roads. The consequences of that are staggering. That's why I gave you the report about Kansas's suicides, just as the tip of the iceberg. We are sacrificing the quality of life for most of our people. We are funding a kind of political and moral corruption that worries all kinds of people in America across the spectrum. Yes, taxing corporations and the rich will have some consequences and will lead to some problems. But what we are not doing by that, not taxing them, and what we're doing instead is having catastrophic problems across every country that is imposing austerity. We didn't choose austerity because we weighed it against taxing corporations and the rich. Had we had a national debate on that subject and decided as a people to go that way, I wouldn't be making these reports. But we never did. The people pushing austerity are terrified of a national debate about that versus taxing corporations and the rich. You know why they're terrified? Because they know where the majority of people will go. Tax the rich, tax the corporations. Every poll shows it. So we have to keep that debate shut down. We have to keep that alternative off the table. What we do is discuss austerity. But it is not a policy designed to help our economy. It's not a policy designed to get us out of this crisis. It's not a policy designed on the basis of a democratic decision making. It's a policy designed to have a two-step hustle perpetrated on the American people. First, bail out and stimulate the economy, but don't tax corporations and the rich to pay for it. Number two, pay back the debts, pay interest on all you borrowed to bail them out. And again, don't tax the corporations and the rich to pay for that either. Take care of the problem of capitalism without making the capitalists pay. What an extraordinary exercise in a society's self-destruction. For the last part of today's program, I turn, as usual, to the questions you send me. And today's is going to be about property taxes. It's amazing how many questions we get. So I'm going to go into that a little bit, and bear with me. Every person listening or watching this program deals with the property tax one way or another. If you own the kind of property that's taxed, you pay the money. But even if you don't, you pay money to stores, to landlords, the institutions that do pay property tax, and they pass on that property tax to the prices and the rents they charge you. So one way or another, the property tax touches everybody. So what is a property tax? Well, the first thing to always keep in mind is to keep clear the difference between a property tax and other kinds of taxes. So, for example, what does an income tax do? An income tax takes money from you out of your income, you know, the wage you get at the end of the week, the salary you get, is diminished by what is withheld by your employer to pay the income tax to the federal government or the state government, or if you live in New York, for example, to even to the city government. You pay income tax to all three. It's a tax on your income. Another kind of tax is a sales tax. That's not a tax on your income. That's a tax on an expenditure you make. Whether you decide to buy something or not, when you buy it, if there's a sales tax attached, you have to pay the price plus the little bit of sales tax attached to it. A property tax is different. It's not a tax on the income you earn, and it's not a tax on the expenditures you make. It's a tax on the property you own. So it's a different thing. It has to do with what you own, not with what you earn and not with what you spend. So, do we have a tax on property in the United States? Yes. But no. That is, the answer is, as with all great questions, yes and no. Let me explain. First, not all property is taxed. Many of you know that. There are tax exemptions, kinds of property that pay no tax. For example, if you are a religious institution, a church, a synagogue, a mosque, something like that, or a parish house associated with one of those, things like that. If you're a religious institution, you are exempted from paying property tax. Indeed, you're exempted from paying income and sales taxes as well. If you are an educational institution, a school, a university, you are likewise exempted from property tax. And if you are a charitable institution, you know, the Red Cross or something like that, you're also. So there are exemptions. More interesting is the fact that we distinguish between kinds of property. And the most important distinction for you to understand is that we distinguish between what is called tangible property and intangible property. What does tangible mean? Something real, something you can touch and feel that has hard substance to it. So, give you an example. Tangible property includes land. It includes buildings. It includes machinery. It includes automobiles. You know, things you can touch and see and feel. Intangible property is something else, and I'm going to give you examples. It's money. It's stocks and bonds, things that aren't hard substances, but stand for something else. They are kinds of titles to the ownership of something else, but it's not the something else itself. So we have a very interesting property tax system in America. We don't tax all property. That's why I had to answer the question no as well as yes. We tax tangible property. We do not tax intangible property. I cannot stress to you too much what I just said and why it's so important. We do tax in our country houses, land, buildings, machinery, automobiles, boats, hard substantive things. We do not tax the value of property in money, stocks, and bonds. Why this is important? Because the overwhelming bulk of cash money, bonds, and stocks, but above all, bonds and stocks, is owned by the richest people in America. The 1 or 2 or 3% at the top own 3/4 or more of the stocks and bonds. Okay, if you tax real property or tangible property, but you do not tax intangible, you are giving a staggering tax preference to the richest people in the country, which is what our property tax system does. To give you an example of what's at stake, a 1% or less, but a 1% tax on the value of intangible property in the United States would quickly solve the government's fiscal problems, wipe out its deficit in a short time. We don't even discuss it in this country. It would radically alter everything. It would, of course, be a tax that affects mostly the richest folks because they have the stocks and bonds. But you ought to ask yourself the question, why in the world is it reasonable to tax a person who has a car for his car and a house for his home, but not his portfolio of stocks and bonds? It's even more peculiar because if you own a house in a town, you pay a tax to that town on the value of the property of the house. If you sell the house and use the money you got to buy shares of stock, you don't pay any more property tax at all. You've changed the form of your property, but you've just become tax exempt by doing it. As if that weren't enough, let me continue. How does your tax on your land, your house, your building, your car, how does that get worked out? In every community of any size, they have an official called a tax assessor. The job of that man or woman and his or her staff is to go out and assess, determine the value of everything. Because if you're going to tax your homes, your land, you have to know what it's worth. And so what the assessor does is say, okay, this piece of land is worth this amount, this car is worth that amount, this home is worth that amount, and then the town decides what percentage of tax to attach to the property. So let me give you a simple example. If the value of your property is $100, and the city or town that levies the property tax, because that's who usually does it, says, okay, we're going to have a 10% property tax, it means every year you got to send $10 to your city or town. 10% of the $100. $100 is the assessed value of your property. 10% is the rate of tax. You owe 10 bucks to your city or town. That's how it's done. No mystery, nothing terribly complicated. But, of course, if you're powerful enough and you can get to the assessor, you might be able to get the assessor to put a much lower value on your property than it's actually worth. And then you'd have much less to pay. In my example, if I got the assessor to value my property not at what it's worth, in fact, $100, but at only $10, then my bill would be 10% of $10, which would be $1. New York Times became famous last year, and again this year, for pointing out the extraordinary performance of the assessments here in New York City, and this is replicated across the country. One example. 15 Central Park West, a very elegant address in Manhattan. Apartments there were valued for tax purposes at $332 per square foot. You can read about this in the October 26 New York Times. The actual sales in that building were for $7,000 a square foot. Let me do that again. Valued for tax purposes, $332 a square foot. Actual sale value, $7,000 a square foot. Their taxes were dropped because they got inappropriate assessments. Bottom line, we have a tax system that could solve our fiscal problems, local, state, and national. We have a property tax system that should have been made to do that long ago. We have a tax system that is systematically unjust to middle and lower income people. And we have a property tax system that keeps being evaded and avoided in the national discussions about what we do in an economy that isn't working. This is Richard Wolff. This is Economic Update. Please follow us on Facebook, Twitter, and Pinterest. I look forward to talking with you again next week.